is in the hospital. For example, all members wear a green ONA insignia on their badge at work that have their Weingarten rights printed on the back of them. Management has been telling nurses they are not allowed to wear them at work and must wear the Providence supplied logos. Also, stewards on COVID units have been told to stop circulating our commitment cards, and the manager on 8th floor was telling nurses they cannot talk about the Bill of Rights at work. These things are upsetting because it is illegal for management to do this, but the only people who can really do anything about it is the Oregon Nurses Association and their members. So it's up to us to report these things. We have to be smarter than our supervisors, unfortunately.
Most likely you are.
And then one more thing I wanted to add was that nurses have been voted the most trusted and ethical profession in America for the past 18 years. So we need the executives at Providence and the general public to trust us when we ask for help, because ultimately it will allow us to provide better care for our patients. If we can't take care of ourselves, how can we be expected to care for others?
I just want to thank both of you for going to work every day. It's got to be really hard. My father passed away at the beginning of the summer from COVID at the Legacy Hospital at Salmon Creek, and we weren't able to go see him at all. And the fact that there are nurses like you engaged with family members on the phone and Zoom calls for these patients is awesome. Thank you.
That wraps it up for Labor Radio this Monday and every Monday at 6 o'clock on KBOO Portland. You've been listening to Beth Funch and Gabriel Vital, who are nurses with the Oregon Nurses Association at Providence Portland Medical Center. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. You are listening to Prison Pipeline here on KBOO Community Radio. Tonight we are talking with writer and artist Damien Lene, who will be talking about his book and his artwork, and we'll also be talking about an incarcerated person that we both have some concern for, and Damien will also be sharing his story. So welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Thanks a lot for having me here.
Thank you. So Damien, let's start. Can you give us a little sense of who you are? Like, what's your story?
Yeah, no worries. I guess I'll start at the beginning. So, I'm living in Newcastle, Australia these days. I'm from Sydney, Australia. I'm 34. When I was 29, I was convicted of a crime for the first time. The short story is someone in my family told me she'd been sexually assaulted, and I kind of lost it, and I went and committed a series of crimes targeting the person she said did that, and the most serious of that was setting fire to his home. And I'd actually just finished my undergraduate degree right before I went in, and I was working part-time for what would be our equivalent of the National Guard over here. And And that was my first experience going into the prison system in late 2015 it was. I got a 10-month non-parole period, that's a very eye-opening experience. And mm-hmm. Feel free to interrupt if you want to, ask me anything in particular. But I went in there, and I figured I just finished my undergraduate degree, and I was like, oh well, if I go to prison, worst case scenario, I'll have some quiet time to start my master's. And I've been told in other states in Australia and also in parts of the US, it's relatively, you know, relatively being the key word, easy to study in prison. In New South Wales, the state I was incarcerated in, inmates can't get access to computers for educational purposes. So
now, pretty quick. I would like to ask you a couple of questions before we go much further. One of them is, this is my own bias, so you'll have to excuse my lack of professionalism, but a lot of people would feel that you were justified in your action if someone that you love and care about was, you know, seriously assaulted, especially sexually assaulted. That brings up really strong feelings.
Well, that was particularly strong feelings for me, because I was abused as a child, and when I told my father and stepmother who I was living with at the time, they didn't believe me. So I had this like kind of revenge fixation, and as soon as she told me that, I kind of snapped. And to be honest, like I don't regret targeting that individual. I don't think he's a particularly nice person, but I can't say I did it for her. I did it for me because I was angry.
Right.
And so, I mean, there are elements of it that are regrettable, but I mean, like for women in particular, like I've had a lot of people reach out and say something along the lines of, I really identified with what you did. I wish somebody had done that to the person who attacked me. So, yeah, I did.
Was the person who assaulted her, was that person ever charged with a crime?
No, and that's mostly why I did it. If he had been charged, I would have been like, well, the law did its job. But unfortunately, as you're probably aware, especially when it comes to sexual assault, the law isn't very good at getting convictions. And that was if he had been convicted and received even like a moderate punishment, I would have, I wouldn't have done that. But yeah, that had a lot to do with it. And
thank you. My next question is, I'm very familiar with the American penal system, as a producer of a radio program, a co-producer of a radio program that documents issues related to incarceration. But I'm not familiar with the Australian penal system. Can you describe a little bit of what it's like to go to prison in Australia?
Yep. I've done one American podcast previously, and one of the first things they asked me was like, oh, 10 months, wouldn't you have gone to jail rather than prison? And that was the first thing I had to clarify, was that there's no difference between jail and prison. If you're in the custody of the state, you're in the custody of the state. So there aren't like different institutions for shorter sentences. So that's something that sets us apart a bit. We, like, as you're probably aware, the percentage of people in America incarcerated is higher than anywhere else on the planet, significantly higher. We're more in line with, like, you know, first world countries. I can't remember what the top off the top of my head, but
Northern Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're more middle of the line here. It is very expensive to incarcerate someone in Australia, much more than America. I'm not sure why, but it's my understanding it's about $40,000 a year in America. In Australia, it's more than twice that much, almost maybe two and a half times. For the return they get on that, it's not particularly good, because I've been looking into the prison system a lot since I got out. I've been like, one of the first jobs I got out of prison was actually working for a news website here in Australia, where I wrote opinion pieces on the prison system, rather. Unfortunately, that website closed down back in May, thanks largely due to the coronavirus. But as I was doing my research, I found it's relatively easy to do like your GED in prison in America, I've been told. Education in Australia is pretty poor by comparison, but we have the same overall issues that we have, like for example, like, you know, the politicians don't make prison reform a priority, because, you know, it's not an issue that a lot of like your average Joes care about, and so there's not a lot of votes to be gained for it, and so on. But I do watch, like, I have in the past watched like the American like prison shows, and it looks a lot harder, looks a lot tougher. Mm-hmm. There, like, we something we don't have in Australia is that anywhere near as bad is like they don't like I actually used to my ex-wife is from Tennessee, and the first time anybody actually asked me like what race are you, I was in America, and I'm like, what do you mean what race am I, what does that even mean? And I'm human, you know, so I mean nobody asked me what race I was when I went into a prison in Australia, and they didn't put me in the block with the other, like I'm actually, my father was half Chinese, half Pacific Islander, so I'm brown, white, and Asian, so I wouldn't have would have had a hard time answering that anyway. But like, yeah, like I'm kind of fascinated by how segregated the American system is, whereas in Australia, I mean, like, you know, you do get like indigenous inmates kind of band together, and you know, there was a like a little bit, you know, there were people who would hang out, but it wasn't like, you know, you couldn't talk to members of other races, you couldn't socialize, that there wasn't any big thing like that. So that's something that I've found is, at least that I'm aware of, is fairly unique to America. And
so you went in for 10 months. What did you do with your living situation and with your personal effects while you were incarcerated?
Well, no one's ever asked me that before. That's a good question. It was actually while I was on bail, I'm like, what am I going to do with my car? What am I going to, and then, you know, I was on bail and I was actually like, I was kind of making my way through a bucket list because I didn't know whether I was going to get like 3 or 5 years or something. And I was actually going, I was driving somewhere to do a scuba diving course because that's something I'd always wanted to do. And I actually crashed my car, wasn't at fault, but yeah. And then I was written off and I was actually relieved because I'm like, hey, I've got an insurance payout. Now I don't have to worry about it. But I've always been a minimalist. I didn't have that many things, and thankfully a friend was just stored it in her garage, so that wasn't too bad. But I did actually make an effort to get rid of a lot of stuff. It was an excuse, you know, when people, like, when they move house, they get rid of some things. Well, I'm like, well, I'm going to jail, so let's get rid of some, you know,
right. So
that wasn't a huge problem for me. I've been told that a long time ago, maybe 15 years ago or so, the prison would actually look after your effects in here. But yeah, that ended a long time before I went in.
You're listening to Prison Pipeline here on KBOO Community Radio. We're talking with Damian Linné. He was incarcerated for about 10 months for kind of an act of revenge, you know, because of an assault on his your partner. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. But anyway, so we're talking about the Australian prison system. We're also going to talk about your book and some of your artwork. Why don't we talk about your book right now? Because, you know, this is a very short show. It actually goes by really fast. So
yeah.
You've written a book. What is the name of your book?
The book's called Scarred, and it's about a vigilante serial killer. It's set in the streets of Sydney. And I ran out of publishers in Australia to submit it to, and I ended up sending it to one that's based in Seattle, and they end up picking it up. So I've got an American publisher, 10th Street Press, but so as I mentioned earlier, I went in and I wanted to study and I couldn't, and I also wasn't eligible for therapy because unfortunately, like, they've got one of those systems where they wait till things get really bad before they help you, so you had to be assessed as medium high risk of reoffending to be eligible for therapy, whereas I was a low to medium. And so I suddenly found I had nothing to do for 10 months, so I was like, all right, well, you're gonna go brain dead if you don't do anything, so what can you do? And I'd had this idea for a story in my head for a long time, actually since I was 17. I'm glad I didn't write it then, because it would have been terrible, you know, not a lot of life experience. But I had in my cell was a few pieces of paper and a pen, and I just started writing. And when I was sentenced, the magistrate who sentenced me, she described me as a vigilante. And that was, I'd always kind of had this revenge, bit of a fixation because of not being believed about being abused as a child. And so I'd already had this kind of vague revenge idea in my head. But then I decided to just play on that. And people do ask me if my, like, because I wrote a book about a vigilante killer and I was in prison for being a vigilante, and people do ask me if it's based on a true story, and not really. I've kind of taken myself as a very base template, and I've exaggerated the living hell out of everything. Like my father was quite abusive, for example, but he wasn't like sadistic. He was just, spare the rod, spoil the child, and you know, went way too far in that regard. Whereas the character in my book, he's actually quite badly abused by his father. And so basically I was like, all right, I know what happened to me and that made me this angry. So what if I do this to the character, and let's see how much angrier and more, antisocial he becomes as a result. And I also was kind of experimenting with, when I set fire to this guy's house, I didn't actually plan to do that. I went there to beat him up. And I was actually kind of worried that once I started beating him, he'd end up dying. And it was kind of, the book's a little bit of a what if as well, because I'm like, my character has no such hesitation. So I was like, all right, what if somebody had died? And then what if you just stuck, slippery slope, if that kept snowballing? And by the end of the book, the kills get up to double digits. And so I was trying to experiment with how far I could push my character and how far he could go before the walls inevitably came crashing down, because you can't be a deranged killer and expect to get away with that forever. So
now, what is a vigilante serial killer? What is that exactly? Is that some reason that he's being a serial killer? Is that it?
Yeah. Oh, so he's trying to cleanse the world of anyone he thinks is making it worse. But he does have a very skewed perception of the standards are low at times. He does kill some particularly horrible people, like a child molester at one point. But then he also murders someone for a common assault of a woman, which again is horrible. But does that justify murder? And he doesn't, at the beginning of the book, he's not planning any of his killings. He sees things he thinks are wrong with the world, and he tries to fix them in the only way he knows how, because he has his own mental health issues and limitations of thinking. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like the mindset of most people who are in warfare.
Yeah, well, I suppose you could say he considers himself, a one-man army trying to fix things, because he hasn't had a lot of structure and people looking out for him as a child, and now he's on this, he's got this fixation, he honestly thinks he's making the world a better place, and most people would say at points he actually is, because nobody wants to be living next to a child molester. But it does follow, I've got on the back cover, this was actually a quote from the first person who reviewed my book, but a poignant debut about serial killers on the streets of Sydney. Scarred explores the addictiveness of vengeance and the tragic mistakes made by the misguided. And I asked my reviewer if I could put that on there and tweak it a bit. And that was I was kind of touched by that analysis. But I'm actually constantly amazed by the different reviews I get, and people see my characters differently to the way I imagine them in my head. But yeah.
Does your character come to an apotheosis? Does he come to a moment of realization or understanding of himself or of what he's done? I'm just curious, because I think that a lot of times when we fantasize about violence, we're not really understanding how violence actually affects not only the people who are enacted upon, but also the actors themselves.
Yeah.
And one of the things that violence really does is it has all of these sideways trajectories for consequences that are never really predicted or understood. And the other problem with violence is that it oftentimes re-traumatizes both the person who's perpetrating the violence and the person who's experiencing the violence. And if the intent is to alter behavior, it's probably going to have the opposite effect.
Yeah, I completely agree with what you said there. The ending of my book is my favorite part. People ask me if I planned the whole thing out, and no, at no point did I know what was going to happen more than about three chapters in advance. And yeah, it did kind of like, I couldn't wait to get locked in at the evening because I wanted to know where the chapter would go next. And the ending of the book's my favorite. He does, my main character, there is an element, definitely an element of closure. Something that I've actually, I think I've done particularly well, and I'm kind of hesitant of, yeah, how much do I give away, but I kind of paint a picture whereby you realize he's never going to be completely better, but he's reached as much closure as he's ever going to get. Mm-hmm. And I people tell me, like, I did an interview with a book podcaster, Bear Books in the UK, and they said like the ending was their favorite part, and it's mine too. I think it really wraps it up well. And you know, people ask me as well, is there going to be a sequel? And I'm like, no, this is my main character, his name is Jason. This is Jason's story and it ends here. And I mean, I could milk it for a sequel if I really wanted to, but I think that would be a bad idea. I kind of get, you know, thoughts of like, you know, Weekend at Bernie's part two, you know, they should have just left it alone. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm going to do with mine. I do, you know, get what you're saying about like, you know, Jason's got this, you know, idea for revenge and he thinks it's going to make things better, but it just keeps escalating. And I mean, I can empathize with that to a point. For example, like I said, I didn't, unfortunately, I didn't commit the crime for, in my head, I was kind of thinking it was for my partner at the time. But yeah, to be honest, I did it. Now I realize I did it for me because I was angry. And one of the, like I said, I can't bring myself to regret it on any level because I'm really happy with how my life's progressed and how I've actually, you know, once I hit rock bottom, I realized I needed therapy and now I feel much better. But for example, like one of the reasons she didn't want me to do anything was because she, for her, it was very private that she'd been raped, and she didn't really want that to get out. And as a result of what I did, it kind of became public knowledge. And so that's definitely regrettable. Like there are elements of like, there's definitely things I'm actually writing a memoir. I've finished now. I've only recently started submitting it to publishers. And I my former American partner, we ended up getting married in Vegas. That's another story in itself. But the tagline I'm going for the back of my book is I guess I put torching that rapist's house in the same box as the time I got married in Vegas, in the sense that it was a hell of a experience and I don't regret it at all. But that being said, I'd be very hesitant to do it again. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's some, yeah. So I don't have really regrets, but I mean, there are definitely things I'd either do differently or wouldn't do at all.
We're talking tonight with Damien Lanay. Damien is an Australian author and someone who's experienced incarceration firsthand. And we're talking about Damien's new book. What is the title of your book again, Damien?
Yeah, it's called Scarred. Published by 10th Street Press. I'm sure you'll be able to see the spelling of my name in the title of the podcast. But it's available on Amazon, Kindle, and most. But it's.
Did you find that the experience of writing the book was cathartic or therapeutic in any way while you were incarcerated?
Yeah, it sounds like a bit of cliche, and I've definitely met people who said, "Oh, this wasn't cathartic." Like my book wasn't cathartic at all. Like I was kind of re-traumatized. But I did find I got a lot of closure out of things from it. And one of them was actually, ironically, I'd for some reason I didn't know, I've talked to other people and they were like, as they were writing a book, they didn't realize like some of the things it was actually about. And I actually, without going into too much detail, I had a family member who stopped talking to me, wouldn't reply to my letters in prison. And I couldn't figure out why. I didn't actually find out till about a year ago. And that's another story for another day. But I didn't realize that subconsciously I was trying to compensate for losing my relationship with that family member by inserting someone into the book that my main character could find closure with, because with his connection with this person, he starts feeling like he has a family. And I actually, it wasn't until I finished writing it and put it aside for a month and then took it out and read it again that I actually had a really emotional moment where I'm like, oh my God, I've this is me, my subconscious, trying to get over a loss in my own family. But I did find a lot of it cathartic. One thing, you know, I told you, I said I was abused as a child, and all my revenge issues were because I couldn't do anything about that. Whereas I like to think I killed that person by proxy via my book, and I'm definitely glad. I mean, I spent a lot of my teenage years thinking about killing that person. I'm glad I didn't now, because I would have thrown my life away. But killing him in the book, however, was a very positive experience. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking tonight with Damien Lemay. Damien is the author of Scarred, and we're just talking about his experiences with incarceration and writing. We were also going to just mention, Damien, someone that you first contacted us about, a prison pipeline. It was a man who's sentenced to 241 years in prison, I believe in Missouri.
Yeah.
And you first reached out to a prison pipeline just to let us know to maybe begin having a conversation with this person to see if we can get him on our show to talk about his sentence, which is exceedingly cruel and unjustified. But can you tell us a bit about Bobby?
Yeah, so his name's Bobby Bostick, and he's serving the longest sentence ever given to a child in Missouri for non-homicide offenses. And yeah, I read an article about him by BBC News in the UK. I was just covering his story. He had a Supreme Court appeal, and I was reading his story, and he mentioned a lot of things I resonated with. One in particular that comes to mind was he said, like, the most motivating book he read in prison was the autobiography of Malcolm X. And I had the exact same feeling. You know,
great book.
Yeah. And you're like, and here's someone who's been where you are and has moved on and was able to, you know, have a, you know, very good life, unfortunately, before he was assassinated. But like, yeah, it was really motivating to see that's what somebody could do once they got out of prison. And so I sent Bobby a letter, partially because I knew firsthand how important it was for me to get a letter in prison. And I sent him a letter because he had a Supreme Court appeal, and unfortunately the Supreme Court just denied to hear his case, as they do, without giving a reason. And I sent him a letter saying, I just heard what happened to him, wanted to say, you know, best wishes and sorry, and you know, yeah, here's a bit about me and stuff. And I was expecting him to write back, but he actually reached back and he asked me if I could help him, because he didn't seem to have much support actually in America, and which I was kind of surprised about. And so I've been advocating for him for about 3 years now. I've created his Instagram account, and I actually outsourced his Twitter account to a friend of mine in Europe. And people find this hilarious, like the two main people that are campaigning for Bobby in Missouri are a guy in Australia and a woman in Europe. And so we're on Instagram and Twitter at Free Bobby Bostick. And if listeners can only do one thing to take a minute out of their day, if you go to change.org and search for Bobby Bostick, you can find the petition for him, and signing and sharing, that's a big help. But
Instagram, that's Free Bobby Bostick. That's BobbyBostick.
That's right. Yeah. So it's the same handle on Instagram and Twitter. And and we've got this website up, a petition for him on change.org. Somebody else who I don't know has one on DIY Roots Action. So if you could sign that too, that'd be good. But we don't have any control over that, so we don't know if it's going to get shut down or anything. But I wrote to him, and we've been in correspondence for about 3 years, and it's actually been a really interesting journey, because I reach out to a lot of people, and I actually spoke to someone running for the, you know, House of Representatives in Missouri on the phone. It was probably a couple of months ago, and we had a big chat, and I talked to all these people, and there's a lot of support for Bobby. And unfortunately, the only as of today, the only way he can get released is if there's a clemency from the governor, Mike Parson, which is, so, you know, sometimes it's a little bit frustrating advocating for Bobby, because, you know, all we really need is this person to give him clemency, and I don't think that's going to happen in his term. But all we can do is keep trying. You know, we've got, if you go to the Free Bobby Bostick Instagram, we've got a link in our bio of how to contact the governor. Just send him a, you know, polite message just to keep the pressure up, like, you know, get this clemency approved. Unfortunately, in January this year, they It was actually a Republican, and he got a Democrat to co-sign the bill. They introduced this bill into the Missouri House of Reps, which would have given any child sentenced to more than 15 years in prison the possibility of parole after 15 years. And they explicitly did that for Bobby, this Republican. Nick Schroer went and met him in prison. And then coronavirus happened, and every bill that was tabled in January got thrown out.
Your book, again, is called Scarred, and where can people find it?
Yeah, you can definitely get it on Amazon and Kindle, and yeah, like I said, most ebook formats.
Thank you. And the campaign to free Bobby Bostick, again, where could people find that petition you mentioned?
So our petition's on change.org, and there's a separate one on a website called DIY Roots Action. And yeah, we're on Instagram and Twitter at Free Bobby Bostick, BobbyBostick, and
on change.org. Damien, it's been a real pleasure talking with you. I hope you can come back sometime.
Yeah, I'd love to. So yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you, and have a good night.
You too.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kboo.fm.
Have you gotten your flu shot? It's never too late to protect yourself, your family, and your community against the flu. This year, it is more important than ever.